LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and today we present part 2 of our interview with John Michael Greer, discussing his latest book, Dark Age America, Climate Change, Cultural Collapse, and the Hard Future Ahead. The interview resumes as we continue to discuss humanity's widespread unwillingness and even inability to face the future. The future already being shaped by gathering social, political, economic, an environmental breakdown. For those of you who haven't heard part one, here's the background. As we lurch on into the early parts of the 21st century, converging crises in energy, economy, and environment are rapidly undermining the foundations of industrial civilization and the materialistic way of life which so many of us take for granted. Energy, because cheap, easily accessible fossil fuels are running out, and industrial civilization as we know it simply cannot be sustained by renewables. Economy, because at almost every level, global, national, corporate, and personal, we are drowning in debt that cannot and therefore will not be repaid, but whose unravelling will cause mass destruction of governments, banks, entire industries, and millions of lives. Environment, because centuries of industrial civilization have wreaked havoc on the biosphere, triggering catastrophic climate change while poisoning the ecosystems on which life on Earth depends. Factor in population growth, mass migration, and escalating terrorist threats, and you have a dangerously unstable situation. Despite the protestations of puppet politicians, elite economists, and utopian scientists, no amount of wishful thinking, money printing, or shiny new technology will ride to the rescue. The Prius of our dreams is heading straight for the brick wall of reality, and the current convulsions such as the Brexit referendum in the UK, the impending implosion of the European Union, and the election of Donald Trump as US President are but the latest wave of woes crashing on the shore of a fantasy future we fashioned for ourselves in a brief moment of gas-guzzling madness. Under the illusion of invincibility, we still tell ourselves that this time it's different, but as we shall soon discover, forces far beyond our control have other ideas. In his most uncompromising work to date, John Michael Greer maps possible futures for America during the hard times ahead, and it's clear that before things get better, they're going to get a lot worse. Yeah, I would say from my observations in general, but also amongst people I come into contact with, even people middle age of my generation, but notably people younger than that, there's a lot less planning for the future going on. That's how it seems to me. Mm-hmm. There's the usual vague aspirational stuff about if you press someone, it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, we want to own our own house someday, and you know, we'd like to move to this part of the country, and we'll have kids someday, and yada yada yada, you know. But it's not the way that I remember my friends when they were starting out in their 20s and maybe met a girl, got married, started a family. There was much more, I want to do this at this point in time, and then I'll take that qualification, and then we'll do this and we'll do that. And by that time, I want to have that sort of pension in place. And it was quite goal oriented to the point where sometimes they'd write them down. And I see a lot less of that now. It's kind of just because people, I don't think people feel that they can do it. It's part of not thinking about the future. As far as people along the lines you describe, you know, drowning out the noise in the depths of their minds in sports bars or whatever. Today, I saw a friend posted on social media a new compilation of Black Friday clips from American stores. You'll know exactly what to expect here. I've seen my fair share of them. In this particular case, I find myself, not hardly surprising really, but I've watched them in the past. I couldn't watch this. It was about 7 or 8 minutes compilation of clips. Mm-hmm. I watched a bit of the first one, and then I clicked forward a couple of minutes, and then forward another couple of minutes. I just stopped it. I said, I cannot watch this. Mm-hmm. It was just like wild animals. I mean, that even does wild animals a disservice because they're normally a bit more orderly about these things. But it's not mm-hmm. just... Now, my friend, she said, her comment was, this is what you get. This is a product of massive economic inequality and also the sort of knee-jerk reactive thing that you get from modern advertising, you know, where people just want the latest thing and they've got to have it and they can't wait. And if they can't afford it, they want it anyway. But for me, looking at it, it was like... there's a deeper level of psychosis or mental illness involved here. This is not normal. If you were from another planet or you were somewhat familiar with the human species, but you didn't know that this activity was taking place inside electrical stores or sportswear stores or whatever, then you would think this was a fight for absolute survival to the death, that these people were fighting mm-hmm. to stay alive, not that they were fighting to get a widescreen TV or a games console.
Yeah, one of the things that I see in this country is the way that people have allowed their sense of identity to depend on the products they have to an insane degree. And so, in a sense, it is a fight for survival. It's a fight to be someone. You know, I'm a person with a widescreen TV. That gives me something to be. Otherwise, I'm nothing. And it is insane. It is psychotic, as you said. And we have a whopping bad case of it here in the United States. Black Friday, this year's Black Friday sales were off sharply from last year's, and last year's were bad. Fewer and fewer people have the disposable income. I haven't seen really detailed breakdowns on the decline in sales, the decline in number of shoppers, money spent, this kind of stuff. All of those are down. But I do know that people who've been talking about this, you know, they've been to this mall or that mall or the other mall and they said, it looked like a ghost town. It looked like an ordinary Thursday or something. It was not, where are the crowds? So there are still, you know, places where people are going wild, but in some cases, it's because really drastic sales, in some cases money-losing sales, are being offered just to move product. So while the screaming and the psychosis is going on, at least, you know, it's becoming less profitable.
I was just going to say a word about population here, because this ties in with the three E's, as we have mentioned, mm-hmm. and it's particularly relevant to the sort of time scale that you're looking at in the new book, you know, the next mm-hmm. few hundred years, 500 years, mm-hmm. In North America, and this will apply to a lot of other regions of the world and industrial nations. And population, mm-hmm. of course, much talked about in terms of it being a problem, it not being a problem. There's been all sorts of discussions and arguments and bum fights about this since the probably limits to growth, but certainly going back to Malthus, for example, you know, this is mm-hmm. not a new concern, mm-hmm. not a new concept. There might be an issue here. You address this in the book, how population might actually come to be reduced. Because as you said earlier on, there's this thought experiment whereby if population keeps growing and no one seems to be talking seriously about it reducing or how that might happen, eventually there'll be so many people that will all be stood right next to each other on the earth and in the ocean. And that'll be it. There'll be no more room for anything. That's absurd. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So what is actually
going
to happen?
Where are we going to be growing food? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And we're talking about in the potential long-term future, medium to long-term future, we could be talking about billions of people sort of, whether natural causes or otherwise, not being here anymore.
The first thing that I have to remind everybody when it comes, well, there are two things I have to remind everybody when it comes to population. It's not that, you know, billions of people will die. Those billions of people are going to die one way or the other. All of us die. Okay? No human being lives forever. And so we've got a death rate. Okay? There are 7 billion people on the planet. All 7 billion of those are going to die at some point. it matters that there is the variable here is how effectively do they reproduce. Now, the second thing is that population is a dependent variable. It is not some outside force that controls itself. It is a function of various complex variables, largely relating to available resources. Okay. If you do not have food, you will starve to death rather than reproducing. Now, one of the reason that I point these things out is that there's a presupposition that the only way population can decline, the only ways, are on the one hand, apocalyptic catastrophe. On the other hand, some kind of voluntary decision to reduce our population. Now, people have been trying to do the voluntary population reduction thing as I recall, they were certainly in full swing when I was a kid and we had 3 billion people on the planet. There are now 7 billion people on the planet. They're still trying the same thing. Obviously, it doesn't work. But we're running out of resources. We're running out of energy resources. We're running out of topsoil. We're running out of stable climate necessary to grow foodstuffs. And one of the ways we can see this beginning to shape up is the fact that the rate of population increase in large sections of the third world, places that had very high rates of population increase 10 years ago, has dropped sharply. They're running up against the hard limits to growth. And so I think you will find as we proceed that death rates will rise above birth rates in those and other areas. That's already the case in the United States and Europe. The death rate, both in the United States and in Europe, the death rate is so far above the birth rate that populations will be declining steadily, except for immigration. And as that process continues, as the limits to growth clamp down, we will see population decline, not via catastrophe. I mean, there will doubtless be wars and plagues and famines and things like that, but mostly it's simple demographics. People who no longer have the resources to survive to reproductive maturity or to reproduce. And death rates rise above birth rates, and the population declines and declines and declines. It's not just as it took us quite a while to get here, up to 7 billion. It's going to take us a while to get back down, but we will. One of the reliable things in terms of the decline and fall of civilizations, when you have full-scale civilizational collapse, you have the full process of decline and fall unfolding over the usual few centuries. At the bottom, your population level is typically around 5% of what it was at the top. So we have 500 million people in North America right now, something like that. Okay. At the end of the thing, we might have 25 million. 25 million people in the entire continent. This does vary. It depends a lot on whether a society in decline is able to maintain some kind of political stability, some kind of organizational stability. When Rome fell, for example, the Western Roman Empire populations collapsed dramatically. I remember an account of a war between two kingdoms in the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy or very early on. And so these are two kings, and they have their armies, and the two armies had fewer than 100 men each. That was the army of a kingdom in those days. There were very few people. You read early Anglo-Saxon poetry, and you get a very clear sense of a landscape that's dotted with little villages with vast empty tracts between them. And old Roman cities here and there, where everyone thinks, well, those must have been built by giants. People could never have done something like that. And they're, of course, completely empty, except for people going into situ to pry loose stone. That's a post-Dark Age environment. But that was the Western Empire. The Eastern Empire population decline was about 50% because the Eastern Roman Empire morphed into the Byzantine Empire, retained a fair amount of stability and economic integrity through the whole process. And so their population only declined by half. We could see similar transformations this time around. North America, the nations are too big. The level of environmental trauma that we're facing is too big. I expect us to be around the 25% range, or what am I saying, the 5% range in terms of how much population we'll actually have compared to what we have now. Europe, if it plays its cards right, might be better off. Might not. It's going to be a messy time.
One other phenomenon that I just want to briefly touch upon, which is really very much in the headlines now, and that is mass movements of people, mass migration, immigration mm-hmm. as well. That's a real hot potato mm-hmm. here in Europe at the mm-hmm. minute. We did a conversation about Brexit, about Britain leaving mm-hmm. the UK, more correctly, leaving the European Union, and immigration mm-hmm. being a huge issue at back of all that. I also did a show with a guy called Giles Slade, and that was called American Exodus, and that was about future mass movements of populations across North America. You address this in your new book. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think that, because we can also talk about politics here, because that's been politicized and used as a football or a club to beat other people, however, you know, however you want to express mm-hmm. it. And it's been mm-hmm. seen, again, as always, the problem is the other. It's certain, you mm-hmm. know, people who have the wrong color or people with the wrong accent or whatever it happens to be mm-hmm. coming from somewhere else to muscle in our resources. But take all of that, all those prejudices and things out of the equation, and those differences between people, the superficial differences, this is just something we're going to have to get used to. And for me, this is the big elephant in the room when it comes to what's happening in the Middle East at the minute. All these people, mm-hmm. to use a political term that was used by mostly the right wing here in Europe and the UK, people swarming from the Middle East into, they're doing mm-hmm. that. I attended a lecture recently by an Iranian university lecturer working here in the UK. And the upshot mm-hmm. of that was, I was so pleased to hear him say it, that what's going on in the Middle East is down to food and water. And he called a big chunk of the Middle East, take out fossil fuels and air conditioning in Qatar and Dubai and all that stuff, he called it ecologically dead or dying. That's what he called the Middle East. So we're going to see these mass movements of people increase.
Now, to some extent, the recent waves of mass movement have been caused by the absolutely ham-handed, idiotic U.S. and U.S. ally policy toward Syria, toward Libya. Hey, Hillary Clinton's thing. Hey, let's overthrow some governments and plunge two big countries into permanent civil war. What a great idea. And so that stirred up a lot of what you're getting in Europe is people from Syria, people from Libya, but not just from there. And yeah, in the long run, the Middle East has had a huge upsurge in population, one of the most dramatic on record. There are millions upon millions of people whose survival is possible only because there's all that oil flowing out, and the oil's running short. And a lot of very expansive assumptions that were made 10, 15, 20 years ago by the Saudi government and the various other governments in the Gulf states, all of a sudden they can't afford it anymore because the price of oil is doing a downswing. But maintaining oil production is increasingly not easy. They have to put more and more of their energy, again, back to the net energy thing. They have to put more and more energy and other resources into maintaining their fuel production. So yeah, it's a powder keg. And exactly how it's going to blow and in what direction is a very, very ugly question. It does no one any good for, on the one hand, people on the right, actually people on the right, people on the left, people making it out to be about race. It's not about race. It's about how many people can you feed. A lot of Europeans have, at this point, have forgotten, which is quite remarkable, as it was not that long ago. They've forgotten the days of the 1930s and 1940s when, feeding the population was really a crisis. I'm afraid they're going to get a reminder of that. Europe is very crowded. It survived. In Britain, a vast percentage of the food you eat comes from overseas. It's a little island with a lot of people on it. And so at a certain point, you have to start asking yourself, how many people can we feed? And nobody wants to ask that question because, of course, progress, growth, everything, the permanent present. There's groceries on the store shelves now. We're not going to think about the future.
Okay, for the last section of our talk, mm-hmm. John, we're going to look a little bit at the prospects for the future. Where we are mm-hmm. Where we are right now, the near future, and maybe some just thoughts and general ideas going forward, just things that we can do and things that we can't do. Mm-hmm. Where we are right now, we've been talking about politics. Let's just mention the U.S. situation. Cometh the hour, cometh the man, Trump.
Hardly surprising, really, in the context of your book. Hardly, you know, not at all surprising to see this guy bulldozing his way through the establishment.
Yeah.
In terms of your concepts in the book of abstract power versus concrete power and how that'll play out in the future, is Trump even 5% tribal warlord as opposed to ineffectual bureaucrat? Is he the first future echo of a strong man in charge?
Yeah. Yes. In fact, that's an important point to understanding his appeal. He presented himself very effectively as an outsider, as somebody who was not part of the bureaucracy, not part of the Washington D.C. blob, coming from outside of the Beltway with his own ideas and with an ear actually turned to what a very large portion of the American people were saying. And of course, all of the people whose interests lie with the existing order had been screeching at the top of their lungs, oh my God, he's a racist, he's a sexist, he's a homophobe, he's an Islamophobe, blah, blah, blah. That's because they don't want to talk about the issues that he's raised and the fact that a very large number of Americans think that they are the problem, not him. So, yeah, Trump, the thing is, we're going to get, Trump is, as you say, a very faint first echo. If he plays his cards well, if he has a successful presidency, manages to achieve a certain amount of, you know, at least some movement toward getting the U.S. out of the trade treaties that have ground our working class into the dirt, enforcing our immigration laws, doing a few other things like that, he could actually stabilize things for a while. One of the problems we always have in a society on its way down, and I discuss this in the book, of course, is the way that society splits into a political class and everyone, and the people who are excluded from politics. We've got a whopping case of that here in the United States. We've got our media, you know, we've got our pundits, we've got our political class, we've got our talking heads in various places. The affluent, the people along the two coasts and the bicoastal affluent privileged bubble, for whom everything is fine and all that matters is you know, getting a woman to the White House. Even, you know, despite her records with regard to war and so on and so forth, we get into that. And then you have everyone else whose views and needs and interests and concerns have been completely excluded from the political process. And the everyone else, we're told by the media. I mean, every newspaper in North America, or in the United States, as far as I know, backed Clinton. And yet, the people just sort of shrugged and said, no, thank you. One turkey this November is enough. And they voted for Trump. And the screaming that you hear, the shrieks of outrage, the histrionic grief and terror and all this kind of stuff, all the two-year-old tantrum that's been in the media, the various privileged classes are doing, that's born of the realization that they don't have the power they think they do, that they can't simply snap their fingers and make their sort of lessers, you know, leap to behave the way they're told. If Trump had lost 4 years from now, we might well have had something worse. I don't think a lot of people in Europe really realize just how tense, how bad the situation is here in the United States, how much it resembles a society in free fall. You know, you get away from the nice rich coastal bubbles, and you're in a country that is in profound contraction, a country again where the roads are being left to go to gravel, where the housing stock, the buildings look again like this, the Soviet Union in its last days, and for very similar reasons. You have a country in deep trouble and profound turmoil. I've had people outside of the United States, when I've spoken at events, I've pointed out, you know, unless something changes, the United States is within a decade or so of a domestic insurgency. We are looking at the prospect of civil war because millions upon millions of Americans feel completely shut out of the political process. And a great many of those millions and millions of Americans are rather well armed. This is not a recipe for a peaceful future. One of the possible benefits of Trump's victory is that those well-armed people are no longer feeling quite so shut out. And if he can give them some of the things they need, like, you know, taking out the trade treaties that have cost the United States so many jobs, such as pulling us out of this monomaniacal posture of confrontation toward the Russians, the Chinese, anybody else in the world. Bring the troops home, for heaven's sakes. We've spent way too much money on defending the rest of the world. If he can do that, then I think it's still possible that we could avoid a domestic insurgency or civil war here in the United States. If he doesn't, if he crumples, if the DC blob continues on its existing policies, it's going to be a really ugly future.
Now, just as we were saying earlier towards the top of the hour, that money doesn't equal resources, and that the abstraction mm-hmm. of money isn't the answer to the problems. We have this great belief, pseudo-religious belief, in the possibilities and benefits of science and technology. That's certainly where a lot mm-hmm. of developments have come, a lot of really life-improving developments and other mm-hmm. life-limiting developments, distractions and trinkets and what have you. But there's been many mm-hmm. wonderful inventions in the industrial age, particularly into the computerized age, all sorts of marvels that we could only have dreamt of in previous generations. But we're not only into kind of decreasing returns there, and we could do an entire show mm-hmm. on this, but we kind of briefly just have to mention science and technology, the limits thereof. On one hand, we mm-hmm. have this response to the challenges that we're facing that are of the techno-utopian variety, whether it's the transhumanists and virtually everybody engaging in a TED talk, all this talk about artificial intelligence and what that's going to do for us. None of this, again, how the resources for any of this are going to happen or what it might mm-hmm. mean for mm-hmm. Employment or other important human affairs. I think it's very significant that we have the space program. I said it was all but cancelled, the manned space program, and someone argued with me today and said, well, no, it hasn't been cancelled, because the international, the space lab or international space station, whatever the hell it's called, is still up there in low Earth orbit, doing its experiments, whatever. That for me, that's not really the future that I was told about or promised in terms of a manned space program. And then you take into things like the technocratic responses to these things, resource-based economy, zeitgeist movement, zeitgeist non-movement, really. I don't know what they've been doing in the last few years.
First of all, there's a thing called the law of diminishing returns, and it applies to pretty much every human activity. We can see it at work in science. If you look back through the history of any science, you'll find the early discoveries were usually made with really, really simple equipment. I mean, Isaac Newton was working with his own eyes and apparently an apple tree in the process of figuring out the law of gravity. Charles Darwin used very simple gear. The early experiments that gave us the electronic revolution were, again, made with incredibly simple equipment. Fast forward now, the hunt for the Higgs boson. They're pouring billions of dollars into these incredibly expensive things because they've picked all the low-hanging fruit. Here's where you see the limits to science. Again, they're economic limits. There are probably, in fact, I've seen, I don't know, what would you call them? Sort of prospectuses, mind games, if anything. There are things that you could do with, you could learn about physics by getting a cylinder roughly the mass of the Earth in space and spinning it to within like 99% of the speed of light. There's some really remarkable things you could find out about the structure of space-time. How are you going to afford it? This is one of the major limits of science. Okay, it suffers from the law of diminishing returns. Now, the Ray Kurzweils of the world insist that's not the case. It can't be the case. No, science and technology have a law of increasing returns. He provides no evidence. In point of fact, there's been studies done that have gone through things like patent applications and so on. The peak of invention in the Western world happened in the 1880s. That's because they were getting low-hanging fruit. They were getting things that were relatively easy to invent and discover. At this point, it takes much more investment to make a new discovery or to put it to use. Okay, technology is the same way, and it also has, as we've talked previously, the fact that you have to be able to afford to run the technology once you make it. Again, sure, you can have a flying car. Is it going to be economical? No. A few rich people might have. I mean, there have actually been flying cars since, I think, the 1920s. A few rich people get them. They discover that since, a car has one set of engineering requirements, a plane has another, your flying car is a lousy car and a lousy plane that are just happen to be in the same vehicle. You could, for the same price, you get a really good car, a really good plane, and probably pay for the chauffeur and the pilot. So there are limits to technology. There are limits to science. Those limits are being made much, much worse by the way that science and technology have been exploited commercially, and that the externalities, that concept again, of science and technology have been pushed off onto the rest of society. One of the best examples these days in the United States is healthcare. We have the most expensive healthcare in the world, and it's some of the worst. Our infant mortality rates are third world. A lot of people die here because of medical malpractice. And a lot of people know this. A huge number of people have been looking at that, and I mean, it came out a few years back that there are more visits to alternative healthcare practitioners every year in the United States than there are visits to MDs. That's partly because nobody can afford the MDs. But it's also because people are saying, okay, if I go to the MD, odds are I'm going to get, you know, three prescriptions which are going to have 16 horrible side effects and probably won't solve the problem. Or I can go to an acupuncturist or an herbalist or a homeopath, and they'll actually listen to me, and they'll come up with a diagnosis. And even if their treatment doesn't work, it's not going to have the 16 horrible side effects. And of course, the medical industry has responded by trying to crack down on alternative health care. But the thing is, this is building up exactly that kind of anti-scientific thought that I discussed. And again, you're right, it's been discussed in science fiction for decades now. Science and technology pursued without any attention to the human cost is going to get a backlash. It's getting the backlash. The backlash is building right now. And the utopian types, the zeitgeist, there was that embarrassing video Thrive that did rounds a while ago. Everything would be wonderful except evil corporation. And not that there's any evidence. Not that they would, not that they need evidence. It's all feel good stuff. Or, you know, Ray Kurzweil with his singularity, which is, we've talked about this before. It is the fundamentalist Christian, myth of the rapture. Science fiction drag. You've got computers in place of Jesus, robot bodies in place of the glorified bodies of the elect, outer space is heaven, dot, dot, point for point. And Kurzweil has even given a year. It's going to happen by 2049. That's his 2012. That's his nothing happened day. And we'll see if he did the smart thing, and if he will do the smart thing and dies shortly before it happens so he doesn't have to face the embarrassment. None of that is going to make any difference to our descendants. Our descendants are going to be living in a world that has been ravaged by science and technology. Okay. You commented earlier, science and technology have produced a lot of really cool, interesting things. Also a lot of time-wasting things, but they've also produced a vast ongoing amount of destruction. Okay. The global climate change that is plunging the western half of the United States into Sahara Desert conditions. That is flooding, that's going to be flooding the eastern seaboard, that's going to be causing unparalleled human suffering and death over the centuries to come. That did not happen by accident. It happens because our smokestacks, our tailpipes, our science and technology. The nuclear power plants who were scattering across the landscape, making no provision for the cleanup, for some safe storage of the fuel rods once they're used, if there is any place safe. You know, they're going to have to deal with dead zones where everyone knows you don't go there because if you go there, you die. They're chemical equivalents. We're handing our descendants, our science, our technology is handing our descendants a ravaged planet. And if we're going to convince any of them that science and technology are anything other than evil, you know, the evil that destroyed the world, the evil that left them with epidemic cancers from toxic wastes and radioactive wastes, that left them with an unstable climate and rains that sometimes just don't show up, and all the other things, we're going to have to get a move on. We're going to have to start seeing more science being used to help people rather than to assist in the production of externalities so corporations can make a quarterly profit. I don't see a lot of that happening. And unless the, in particular, the scientific community wakes up, shakes itself out of its stupor, breaks out, you know, steps outside the permanent present and looks at the future and says, oh crap, I, You know, I think all those science fiction visions of future societies where scientific inquiry gets you burned at the stake might well happen. That is, it will be because they're making a rational response to what? To the world that science and technology left them. I really do hope that can be reversed. I really hope we can see more, especially in the natural sciences, people turning their backs on the idea that science is our means to conquer nature, as though nature is our enemy, and start you know, teaching people how to, for example, do remediation of toxic waste. So that could be done with mushrooms, by the way. There's a guy named Paul Stamets who's done some amazing things with fungal remediation of poisoned soil. There's all kinds of scientific things that can be saved, should be saved, but it's going to take some work, and I don't see a lot of people getting to it now.
Well, just in conclusion, really, I mean, the wheels are in motion here, as we've been talking about for the past 90 minutes or so. People can see these things happening on all these different fronts, and if anyone wants to be more thoughtful or considerate about this, or reflective, you know, just start looking for it. The more you look, the more you'll find, really. Mm-hmm. I think it's significant. I mean, you've talked about infrastructure and malign neglect over there in North America. A couple of the big infrastructure projects here in the UK that have been bandied about for a long time, I would not put money on them being completed. I'm thinking of the third runway for Heathrow, which we're told is essential for growth. I mean, that thing has been back and forward like a ping pong ball for as long as I can remember. And then there's the so-called HS2, High Speed 2, which is a proposed extension of, as it says, high speed rail tracks from the economic heartland of the UK, which is the south, southeast, through to the north to create the rather catchy sounding northern powerhouse. That's going to cut a swathe through farmland and urban areas all the way through the heart of the country. Again, would I invest in that? Would I even put a small bet on it being completed? No, and I think that's significant. There's a lot of talk about it and a lot of putting it into the long grass yet again. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of this, really, is the sense of possibility kind of going away and things quietly being shelved. I think you see a lot of that now.
And that's an important thing to watch. Because, yeah, basically the mismatch between the fantasies of continued growth and the realities of actual contraction, that's going to widen in the years to come. And as it widens, a lot of people's dreams and hopes and fantasies are going to fall into the gap. I think one of the major things that our listeners can do is keep an eye, you know, mind the gap, as they say in the underground. Keep an eye on the gap between what's being yammered about in the media and what's actually happening on the ground. That's opening into a chasm. And if you just pay attention to the media, you're going to be blindsided by the future.
Final thought on my part. I spend a fair amount of my time working in a museum here, and we have archaeology from Roman through Anglo-Saxon, Viking, Norman, into the medieval period. And a lot of visitors, particularly those from North America, though I'm really not ragging on your fellow countrymen, but that's just maybe their perspective on history, they say, so when the Romans were after the Vikings, right? And I'm going, no. And they're going, okay, what is this Anglo-Saxon thing? When is this? And the reason they're confused is because they cannot conceive of the obvious splendor of what the Romans created through to the Anglo-Saxon period and the fact that the Vikings just didn't build like that. They just did not build on that scale. And they can't conceive of this advanced. I point out the working drain we still have here, the Roman drain that still works. And the underfloor heating and the weapons technology. And they're saying, no, this must be after the Vikings. I'm like, well, it's not. And I think it's significant that when you get through the Viking period and into the Norman invasion, they started to build on a large scale again. What was the style? Romanesque. Why was it called Romanesque? It's because it was, you know, it looked like some of the Roman stuff. And that was a period of 1,000 years.
You have to remember that the educational system in this country has been, quote, reformed, unquote, several times in ways that have made sure that it basically doesn't teach anybody anything. And at this point, somebody graduating, you know, from 12th grade after 12 years of public schooling in America, you could basically assume they know nothing worth knowing about history. They know nothing worth knowing about literature. All that they've done is take multiple choice tests. And study frantically to get the right answers on the tests so that these schools don't get, you know, docked money or this, there's various kind of stupidities involved. One of the other things that's been thrown under the bus here in the United States is the entire concept of education. So, you know, you don't blame them. Don't blame them for too much for being completely clueless about history. That's what, you know, they weren't taught anything. And so don't be too hard on the people who can't get it through their heads that the Romans must have come after the Vikings because the Romans are so much more, quote, progressive, unquote. It's probably the first, that when they visit that museum, it's probably the first time they've ever encountered the Romans.
Okay, well, I will just say for listeners, I mean, obviously a lot of bleak prognosis here in our discussion. Some of your other books in particular, I'm thinking of, say, for example, Green Wizardry. There's some great ideas about how things might pan out in the ecotechnic future. A lot of your work is full of ideas about constructive things that we can do as individuals, as communities, even as nations, how we might respond to this in the future, if we're going to have one. Today, we've been talking about your latest book, as mentioned earlier, Dark Age America, Climate Change, Cultural Collapse, and the Hard Future Ahead. That does strike probably the most unequivocal tone, I think, of anything I've seen you publish in terms of, like, this is going to happen, something else isn't, we must do this, we must not do that. And I think that just reflects where all the issues that you're concerned with are at the minute. They continue to move on apace. Tell listeners anything you'd like to about that. It's widely available. Please tell them about your blog, which is published once a week, and anything else you'd like to share.
Okay. So, Dark Age America is out. It's available at all the usual outlets. You can get it from online retailers. You can also go to www.newsociety.com, order it directly from the publisher. They would be happy to ship it to you. So there's that. There's my blog, thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com. That's a Wednesday evening experience for me these days. I have a new post on the end of the American century taking shape right now, and that'll be up on Wednesday. I also have a book project that will be out quite shortly that may be of interest. You were talking about responses to constructive responses. This one will get. I suspect there will be some very loud shrieks from the Ray Kurzweils of the world. The title is Retrotopia. It is a novel. It is rather, in a certain sense, like Ecotopia, which was so famous a few decades ago. The idea of deliberate technological regression as an effective response to an unstable future, going back from the fancy overloaded, over-upgraded mess of the technology we have now, and scaling it back a few decades or more, going back to what worked, when there are things that worked better than what we've got now. I know, it's a completely heretical idea. I've got a nonfiction book on that titled The Retro Future, which will be out sometime next year, but Retrotopia will be out probably within a week. And that's from Founders House. If you keep an eye on the Archdruid Report, as soon as it's available for sale, I will have, banners and everything to announce it. And that should be fun. It's a fun story. So,
wonderful. Well, lots happening on that front then, John. It just remains for me to say thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
And thank you very much for having me on.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.